Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Selection and Sequencing of Therapy for Metastatic Triple-Negative Breast Cancer. We have a great faculty today, Dr. Anna Garrido-Castro from the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston, and Professor Peter Schmidt from the Barts Cancer Institute in London. This is the first time we've shown this, but I just kind of want to make people aware of when we do these live events, that's just the beginning for us. We then take that content, and now we have multiple ways that we're distributing it through our podcasting, through streaming platforms, our app, website, and a lot of other innovative ways to put out this content that we're getting here. We put out a couple hundred hours a year of that. Today, we're here to talk about metastatic triple-negative breast cancer. And as we do many times, we'll be bringing some real cases from clinical practice. We will be discussing the use of non-FDA-approved agents and regimens. So please refer to the official prescribing information for more. So as we've done many, many times since the beginning of the pandemic, we met with a bunch of community-based medical oncologists. Most of these are general medical oncologists. Dr. Zelkowicz is in the community but focuses on breast cancer. We asked them for cases of metastatic triple-negative disease and particularly questions to ask the faculty. And so that's really going to form sort of the background of what we're going to talk about here today. We're really going to make rounds with our faculty and hopefully get through 8 cases. But I want to just sort of take a breath before we get started, because maybe Peter wasn't quite as aware of this, but Anna, I know you as a lifelong Patriots fan are aware that we're finally, after 6 months of watching, you know, Bobby Flay cooking shows, I think I've seen every single one of them now. Finally, football's coming back to us here in the United States. This coming Sunday, my University of Miami team's going to be playing Notre Dame. I'm all excited about that. And, you know, thinking about football, one of the things I was thinking about is some of the legends you see in football. For me, here coming to Miami to do my training and oncology fellowship in the late 1970s, I got exposed to, you know, a couple of the legends in football, Dan Marino from the Miami Dolphins and Bernie Kosar. Dan Marino came to Miami in 1983, and Bernie Kosar led the University of Miami to a championship in 1983. But shortly after that, we started our group here, and for the first 10, 15 years of our work, we mainly focused on breast cancer. Chuck Vogel, who many of you know, and one of the master clinicians in breast cancer, was my mentor at the University of Miami. He tried to get me to become a breast cancer investigator, but that just wasn't in the cards. But I always loved working with Chuck and making rounds with him. A lot of people are new to oncology. About 30% of our audience has been are either fellows or they've been in oncology less than 5 years. You may not have heard of Richard Pito, but shortly after those two football players came in 1985, he did a presentation that really changed not just breast cancer, but oncology in general, the world overview on adjuvant therapy, which really led to the approval of both tamoxifen and chemotherapy. I remember an incredible program we did with now Sir Richard Pito and Larry Norton from Memorial together. Also, great memories of Bernard Fisher and Gianni Bonadonna, really the fathers of breast cancer, particularly adjuvant therapy. Michael Baum from the UK and many other clinicians who focus on endocrine therapy. Dr. Baum presented the ATTACK trial in, I think, 2003. All the figures we talked about with HER2-positive disease, Dr. Sledge, who led the famous 2005 education session where the adjuvant trials were presented. So just a great time to reflect back on some of these great figures. Now we have a new wave, including you two and many others who will be taking things forward. A lot of these people are still very active. But just before we kind of run down the whole story of triple-negative breast cancer, just kind of curious if either one of you have any thoughts about sort of where we came from in breast cancer and where we are right now and how some of these people contributed. Peter, any thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult where to start. I mean, these are the names we grew up with. These are the names that shaped the early breast cancer development from a surgical point of view, from an oncology point of view, from a radiotherapy point of view. And I think The research environment was very different back then. It was much more academic, but also it was more room for developing bold ideas. Studies were more collaborative, but also cheaper to run. And it's fantastic to see how many great ideas actually led to that progress we had over the last 30, 40 years in breast cancer.
Anna, any thoughts?
Agree. Hard to add anything to what Peter just said. It's really been amazing to see the progress and led by so many greats, and feel very honored as well to have been mentored by some of these amazing clinicians and researchers who I've had the privilege of working with over the past few years.
Yeah, actually, the first interview we ever did, audio interview, was with Dr. Fisher in 1988 when the NCI alert was sent out in hard copy. They literally mailed us this thing that announced that there were going to be two trials coming out showing the positive results for chemo and tamoxifen and node negative disease. I interviewed Dr. Fisher and we went through all the data. At the end, I said, "Well, what advice would you give to oncologists about this?" And you know, he was a little bit of a gnarly guy, you know, and he went, "I'm a researcher. I don't tell people how to practice." And I was like, "Wow, what am I going to do?" And then I thought for a second, I said, "Well, what are you going to do in your own practice?" He goes, "Of course, I'm going to use it. Look at the data." And there, and that really became the model for what we started to do and what we're going to do here today, because we have 8 cases. And what I want to ask you is what you think about the questions are these docs have. We're so grateful to have these docs presenting these cases for us to take a look at. So we're going to start out with a patient not uncommon to see in clinical practice. An elderly patient, 82-year-old woman, a patient of Dr. Favreau, a current smoker. You know, he lives in North Carolina. There's a lot of tobacco in that area. Past history of smoking-related morbidities, myocardial infarction, stroke. Still in pretty good condition, but had recurrent triple-negative breast cancer. Here's a little bit about the case and Dr. Favreau's questions.
82-year-old female who is an active smoker, CAD, has had MIs in the past, has had strokes in the past. Initially met her in 2008. She had left-sided triple-negative breast cancer, for which she had a lumpectomy and post-lumpectomy radiation therapy. We treated her with adjuvant TC times 4. In the same left side, she had a new primary develop in 2024. It was 8 millimeters in size. It was triple-negative and HER2-0, lymph node negative. She developed a stroke around that time, which delayed her potential for surgery. I actually treated her with carbotaxol neoadjuvantly. She went on to have a lumpectomy. She still had residual disease there. At that point, you know, she's been through a lot. She decided she didn't want to take adjuvant capecitabine. And with just in a few months of undergoing surgery, she developed metastatic disease. She actually developed worsening neck pain and back pain. And on imaging, she has extensive bone-only metastatic disease in multiple areas of her spine and hip and pelvis. That's painful. She's currently receiving some radiation therapy to her cervical spine. The question is, you know, what would be a potential option for her? I'm cautious about her because of her age and her multiple medical problems. Her functional status is actually pretty good, but she's been smoking since she was a teenager, actually, and so she really is just kind of basically refusing to quit. So she continues to smoke. I don't think she would agree to or really tolerate chemotherapy, but, you know, would there be a possibility of using a dose-reduced sacituzumab plus pembrolizumab for somebody like this? The questions that then come up with her are, with her active smoking status, we have to be careful about pneumonitis, which I think is definitely one of the most feared side effects of immunotherapy and antibody-drug conjugates.
So, and I should say, too, at the time I chatted with him a couple of weeks ago, he did not have a PD-1 level back, but I'm curious if it is positive, whether you'd be thinking about, adding an IO in this patient. And in general, what your thoughts are. It's much more common to hear a story like this in lung cancer. I don't know how often you see current smokers with breast cancer, but any thoughts, Anna, about this case and his questions?
Yeah, no, this is an excellent case, and you know, it's true. This, you know, this patient developed recurrence, what sounds like about four, with a 4 month disease free interval, so rapidly after surgery and after having received prior taxane and platinum therapy. So we'd definitely discuss systemic therapy options, and in this setting of recurrent disease and no prior immune checkpoint inhibition, so I think testing for PD-L1 certainly is appropriate. And if PD-L1 positive, one could consider the combination of pembrolizumab. And here, given some of the emerging data from ASCENT-04 and also taking into consideration the rapid relapse from prior therapy and carboplatin and taxane-based therapy, I think, you know, it depends on the patient, the comorbidities and concerns in terms of tolerance to prior therapy. But I think considering dose-reduced sacituzumab govitecan would be reasonable in this setting. Again, in a patient who is interested in pursuing systemic therapy in this setting. And it sounds like overall performance status has been good, but there are these concerns with some of her underlying comorbidities. But I do think in a setting of PD-L1 positive recurrent disease with rapid disease-free interval, this combination could be considered. And if PD-L1 negative, then would likely consider dose-reduced sacituzumab as an option here. There are other chemotherapies that could also be discussed with the patient, eribulin, among others. But I do think that here I would discuss the TROP2 ADC.
And Peter, you know, we always say, you know, reimbursement issues aside, because depending upon what country you're in, you may be able to access things, but sort of theoretically, I'm curious, so before we get into the ASCENT data, any thoughts, Peter, about this case? And also in the chat room, Dagmara says something I wasn't aware of. ESMO guidelines in the elderly suggest omitting carbo, but giving paclitaxel plus or minus pembro. Is that something you ever do, Peter? And any thoughts about this case?
Yeah, it's. I mean, I think in a patient of this age, with multiple comorbidities, it's all about tolerability and how fit is the patient and what treatment can she ultimately tolerate. I don't share the concerns too much around her smoking, and I think the risk of substantial pneumonitis with checkpoint inhibitors isn't particularly high. And Neil, you mentioned the lung cancer data. We know that lung cancer patients do quite well with immune checkpoint inhibitors. So that is, for me, not a reason not to give a checkpoint inhibitor. The second concern around and what Dr. Favaro said was not giving chemotherapy, but giving sacituzumab. And again, from my perspective, sacituzumab is chemotherapy. It's targeted chemotherapy. It's highly effective chemotherapy, but ultimately it is chemotherapy. So it is, of course, an option, as it would be to go back in with a taxane, for example, together with a checkpoint inhibitor. We don't usually combine taxane and platinum in the metastatic setting. So it would either be platinum plus a checkpoint inhibitor or taxane plus a checkpoint inhibitor. But of course, sacituzumab govitecan and pembrolizumab have shown fantastic data. And if the feeling is that this patient may only be well enough to receive one line of therapy going forward, and that may be the most effective line. And if you think about one of the data that I was most impressed with was the duration of response with sacituzumab govitecan and pembrolizumab. Yeah. And I went up from 9 to 16 months. And I think if we can make that a tolerable treatment for this patient, that could indeed be an excellent option.
And we'll take it into the data in a second, but first, Dagmara in the chat room corrects me. I thought she did a typo, but actually it's EUSOMA, European Society of Breast Cancer Specialists, a nonprofit group I see is located in Florence, always interested in new programs. But let's take a look at the data, particularly what your thoughts are about it. Anna, this is a slide that your colleague, Dr. Tulaney, showed us in a webinar a couple weeks ago, kind of summarizing some of the guidelines for NCCN and ESMO. But I point particularly down to the bottom where you see future, where you have the ASCENT-04 trial that we're going to talk about in a second. Also, she refers back to ASCENT-03 that we'll talk a little bit, but also the other TROP2 antibody drug conjugate, Dato-DXd, that has a similar first-line trials cooking, both PD-1 positive and negative with IO or not, and we'll kind of see where that heads. But kind of getting back into, and we know, obviously, I'm not going to go through in detail the standard of care prior to ASCO, was pembro plus chemo, the Keynote 355 based on PD-1 levels. We now have three TROP2-directed ADCs, including, I call it SAC-TMT because I have a hard time pronouncing tiramatecan, but slightly different agents, but maybe similar efficacy, slightly different tolerability issues. And anything you want to say about these TROP2 ADCs? In the U.S. now, we have a Dato-DXd approved in ER-positive disease, but still, as we saw, there are these triple-negative programs there. So, Anna, any thoughts about these three TROP2 ADCs and where they are and where you see them heading in breast cancer?
Yeah, it's a great question. So as you showed in the previous slide, so these three TROP2 ADCs, they all carry a topoisomerase 1 inhibitor as their payload. They're all directed to TROP2. There are differences, though, in the drug-to-antibody ratio and the half-life of these drugs, and subsequently also in the dosing and schedule of administration. And I think we've certainly seen the robust data for sacituzumab govitecan in metastatic TNBC. We've seen some initial data for Dato-DXd from the phase 1/2 Begonia trial in the first line setting for metastatic TNBC, and we await the randomized phase 3 trials in that setting. And then SAS-TMT, we've also seen some data from the OptiTROP-Breast01 trial in a very similar setting as Ascent for sacituzumab govitecan, also with robust PFS and OS data, and we await the trials in the first line setting. So I think, you know, we have multiple options that appear to be emerging as TROP2-directed ADCs. There are important differences in the toxicity profile across these agents besides the frequency of administration of the drug, the schedule of administration of the drugs. I think it's very important to note those differences in toxicity profile with, you know, SG being neutropenia and diarrhea being some of those more frequent toxicities, Dato-DXd having those special adverse events of interest, including ocular surface toxicity, mucositis. And of course, we need to monitor closely for ILD or pneumonitis. And then with SAS-TMT, the toxicity profile seems to be somewhat in between SG and Dato-DXd, also with mucositis and hematologic toxicity. So I think more to come, not just on the efficacy of these agents in the first line setting, but also about strategies to try to improve tolerability to all.
And, of course, there are many trials now going on in the first-line setting. We're going to talk about a few of them, but that's obviously a very important area of investigation. In terms of the big presentation at ASCO, the ASCENT trial, that was preceded, of course, by the triple-negative trial, the phase 3 trial, looking at sacituzumab versus physician's choice, where we saw impressive improvement, not only in progression-free, but overall survival with a hazard rate of 0.51 there. It looks like you see benefit regardless of TROP2 expression, although I'm curious whether you think in the future that might be on the table. The ASCENT-03 study right now, all we know is very similar to the 04 study, except this is a PD-1 negative. All we know is there's a press release out that the trial is positive. Hopefully maybe we'll see this at ESMO or sometime this fall. But Peter, of course, here's the presentation everybody's talking about, the ASCENT-04 Keynote-D19 study comparing SG plus Pembro to chemo plus Pembro. And again, at this point, we're seeing a progression-free survival, no survival benefit, but yet there's a crossover that has to be considered. And we know there, as we were just talking about, there's a lot of effort now being looked at of combining IO and ADC and bladder cancer. First-line therapy now is ADC and fortinumab vedotin plus pembrolizumab. We'll see if that's a reality now for breast cancer. Peter, any thoughts about ASCENT-04 and ASCENT-03 and how you see it affecting treatment decisions now and maybe moving forward?
Well, the ADCs clearly have changed the way we are treating breast cancer, and it's clear that they're moving forward and forward and forward. What has always impressed me is not just the long time they work, but also the response rates. And if you look at metastatic disease, and going back to the first case we discussed, this was a patient with symptomatic disease. We only improve her quality of life if you make the cancer smaller. So the just looking at PFS is important, but if you have a substantially higher response rate, as we see with those ADCs, patients will ultimately have a better quality of life and also often be able to have better access to subsequent treatments. That's what we see in the second, third line setting across all types. That's what we are seeing emerging with ASCENT 04 and what I'm pretty confident we will see with the other ADC studies in the first line setting as well. So we will see a PFS benefit. We also will see better response data. But again, one of the questions that, that needs to be asked is the strength of those drugs in disease settings where we already see emerging resistance, or if you have a really sensitive tumor, is there less of a delta between conventional chemotherapy and targeted chemotherapy with ADCs? So although these drugs will be better in a first-line setting compared to chemotherapy, they're also better in a second-line and in a third-line setting. And I think ultimately we will have to come up with different algorithms and choose those patients who will need ADCs or ADC combinations in a first-line setting and those patients who may get it as a second- or third-line treatment.
So a couple of specific questions to follow up, Anna. What about the patient? And many patients with triple-negative disease are getting IO in the neoadjuvant setting. How is that going to factor into your decision about whether to use it if and when they develop metastatic disease? And also the issue, and kind of gets into Peter's question about like where, you know, PFS2, so to speak, but how often do you see patients who don't even get to second-line therapy?
Yeah, those are two excellent questions. So to the first question about rechallenge to IO, so in ASCENT 04, there were very few patients, less than 5% of patients enrolled on the trial who had received prior immune checkpoint inhibition. And so the question about if and how to rechallenge for patients in the advanced setting who have received, for example, the KEYNOTE-522 regimen remains unclear. I think what we also don't know is the prevalence of PD-L1 positivity after progression on the KEYNOTE-522 regimen or recurrence after KEYNOTE-522. And based on some initial data, we do see that PD-L1 positivity tends to be lower in the metastatic setting compared to primary tumors. It's possible that after exposure to multiple chemotherapy regimens and prior IO, that the rates of PD-L1 positivity could be relatively low. The other point that I would make is we've seen recently published some data in terms of the time frame of recurrence post KEYNOTE-522 and other immune checkpoint inhibitor trials. And what we're seeing is that, in fact, the vast majority of recurrences post KEYNOTE-522 tend to occur within a relatively short time frame, so within a year of having completed their adjuvant therapy. And in fact, we also see recurrences during adjuvant treatment on KEYNOTE-522. And so in that setting of highly, you know, refractory disease and patients who relapse during or within a very short disease-free interval, at least 6 months from their adjuvant therapy, that's a scenario in which I think there are limited data to suggest that a rechallenging in that setting with immune checkpoint inhibition would provide benefit. We await some of the trials in the first line setting for looking at combinations of Trop-2 ADC with IO that do allow rapid relapse and prior immune checkpoint inhibition. And so it's possible that those studies may shed some more light on what the activity of rechallenge with IO might be after prior exposure. For now, and based on the data that we've seen from ASCENT 04, I think particularly for the patients who relapse on or within a relatively short disease-free interval of 5-2-2, I would not likely consider rechallenge with immune checkpoint inhibition. But for those who have a more prolonged disease-free interval and who have PD-L1 positive disease at time of recurrence, that is a scenario in which the combination with pembrolizumab and sacituzumab could be considered. Curious to hear also Peter's thoughts.
Well, I'm kind of curious if you could just comment on the other point I was curious about, which is this idea of maybe holding off on the ADC in the long run. But my concern or question is, how often do you see people not make it to second line therapy?
So that's also an excellent question. So to that second point, you know, we've seen some data from different studies, including databases here in the U.S., that really show sobering data in terms of the rates of attrition from first to second line setting, and where about a third of patients diagnosed with metastatic TNBC might not be able to receive a second line therapy. And so with that in mind, really, it does underscore the importance, given the aggressive subtype of breast cancer that this is, of really trying to position the best agents first. I think the sequencing of therapy is still a very important question, unanswered question, in terms of whether the antibody drug conjugate provides overall survival advantage if given earlier versus later in the course of metastatic disease. But the fact that there are patients who unfortunately do not are not eligible to receive second line therapy and beyond really does highlight the importance of selection of the optimal, the agent that may carry, you know, most anti-tumor activity first, while always taking into consideration the toxicity profile and individual patient factors.
So I'm going to move on to the next case and get into another major issue in terms of sequencing in metastatic disease, which is the issue of T-DXd and HER2 low and also ultra low. And actually, this 67-year-old woman who has a PD-1 positive disease also has HER2 ultra low triple negative breast cancer. Here's Dr. Rudolph.
Unfortunately, within 6 months of treatment, she developed progressive lung metastases, at which point I switched her to treatment with sacituzumab govitecan. She was on it for a year, and then had further progression of lung metastases. I then switched her to eribulin. Unfortunately, 4 months later, her most recent PET scan now shows further progression of multiple lung metastases. Through all this, she's been completely asymptomatic. So these were all caught on routine surveillance scans. She has no other sites of disease. While I was thinking about what next as far as her treatment choices, it's interesting that T-DXd is approved only for hormone receptor positive HER2 ultra low disease. It is not approved for hormone receptor negative HER2 ultra low disease. And I wanted to see if there is any data for use in this setting. Is there any reason to believe that it would not work in a hormone receptor negative HER2 ultra low disease? And this population certainly was not looked at also in the DESTINY-Breast06 trial. My last question for triple negative breast cancer population is, they are at a very high risk for brain metastases, similar to HER2 positive disease, although not to the extent of 50%. Regardless, do experts routinely do brain MRI for surveillance of brain to look for metastases in this population? And if so, how often?
So, Peter, this chapter two of the sequencing question, now we bring in the issue of T-DXd. And again, we're not going to spend a lot of time going through the data. I think people are quite aware of what was seen with HER2 low disease and the epic presentation at the ASCO 2022 meeting. But also last year, when we saw the presentation of data by Dr. Sirigliano looking at ultra-low, and as Dr. Rudolph was saying, only in ER-positive disease. So, Peter, for practical purposes, if you could, it sounds like this patient's run out of options and yet still is potentially able to receive therapy. If you could, would you give her T-DXd for, you know, ER-negative ultra-low disease? And generally, how do you think about sequencing T-DXd and sacituzumab in metastatic triple-negative disease, Peter? I won't even ask you about ER-positive. We could spend probably an hour just on that. But let's just stick to triple-negative for now.
Yeah, really important questions. So the first consideration is what drives resistance to an ADC, and it is, in a nutshell, either resistance to the target or to the payload. Now, if patients had sacituzumab govitecan, it makes for me perfect sense to try to switch to a different ADC that targets has a different target, because we see that the resistance is probably more often driven by the payload, rather by the target, but still we haven't got many different payloads available. So switching from SG to TDXD does make sense. The data we have in real life from SG to TDXD or TDXD to SG and other ADCs crossovers, the activity probably goes down to a third. So a second ADC with a similar payload is likely to be substantially less effective than the first ADC. What about HER2, targeting HER2 in triple-negative breast cancer? I think the whole definition of HER2 low and HER2 ultra low is a little bit arbitrary. And we all know if we take repeated biopsies, we will make that ultra low patients with in one biopsy HER2 low. The reason why we don't give TDXD at the moment to patients with HER2 ultra low disease was that the ultra low study was just focusing on ER positive breast cancer. But if you look at the data in HER2 low expression, where we had TNBC and ER positive, there was no real difference between those two disease subgroups. So I don't have a clear reason to believe that a patient with ultra low HER2 expression won't have a benefit if they have TNBC as compared to ER positive breast cancer. But it is a challenge, and the sequencing strategies are at the moment limited by the drugs we have. And as most of the resistance is driven by the payload, switching from one topoisomerase one inhibitor ADC to a different topo-1 ADC is okay, but it's not going to bring us dramatically forward. In the absence of other drugs, I would do this, but our research is now focusing on new avenues there.
So, Anna, I don't know if any, whether maybe you've had any cases where you've actually used TDXD in ER-negative ultra-low disease. I'd be curious if, you know, anybody's seen any responses, not let alone some trial. Would you maybe think about it, if you could, in this 67-year-old lady? And again, how do you think about sequencing and decide what comes first? I was thinking about that current smoker we were talking about before. Would that make you a little hesitant to use TDXD or not necessarily? How do you think about these issues, Anna?
Yeah, no, these are excellent questions. I think in the, you know, as Peter noted, given the activity that we've seen for TDXD in both HER2 low and HER2 ultra low ER positive disease, and we and the data for hormone receptor negative HER2 low disease really does mirror the HER2 low hormone receptor positive data from DB04. There's no reason to think that TDXD could not have activity in a patient who has ER negative HER2 ultra low disease, and we know about the challenges with interpretation of HER2 and the variability and heterogeneity, even when biopsying the same site at the same time in different areas of same anatomic site, we see different scores of HER2. I think the challenge is that it is not currently endorsed by guidelines or in the label, and so coverage of the medication could be challenging. In an ER-negative HER2 ultra-low setting, there is an ongoing study, Destiny Breast 15, that is looking at the activity of TDXD in patients with HER2-low and HER2-0, encompassing null and ultra-low tumors. And there are cohorts for both HR-positive and HR-negative disease. And so that study may shed some light on the activity specifically of TDXD in triple-negative HER2 ultra-low or null tumors as well. To the question about sequencing for triple-negative breast cancer, while certainly for patients who are eligible for either sacituzumab govitecan or TDXD, either option is reasonable. I think we certainly have seen more robust data for the TROP2 ADCs in TNBC with dedicated phase 3 trials demonstrating statistically significant and clinically meaningful improvements in PFS and OS, whereas the data for TDXD do come from an exploratory analysis in the triple-negative setting from DB04. And just given also the clinical trials that are now looking at TROP2 ADCs in the first line setting, I think we're really seeing sacituzumab govitecan and potentially other TROP2 ADCs position themselves as the preferred initial antibody drug conjugate for triple negative breast cancer. But one could envision, you know, a future where we adopt a more individualized approach if we have better methods for quantification of the target. There's already a companion diagnostic computational device for datopotamab deruxtecan based on TROP2 QCS scoring in lung cancer. And if methods such as this end up being developed and validated and show that they can help us select the initial antibody drug conjugate, that may be a way to, in a more personalized manner, select what is the preferred initial ADC based on that patient's tumor.
All right. Well, I'm going to pick up the pace a little bit and start to go through these cases a little more rapidly. Each one has a different issue. This next case from Dr. Zelkowitz, a very interesting question. 68-year-old woman who initially gets treated for localized triple-negative breast cancer with chemo IO, but unfortunately is diagnosed with myocarditis during that time. Here's Dr. Zelkowitz.
Very locally advanced cancer, biopsied, and ER0, PR0, HER2-0. She got classic chemo, and very shortly after starting the AC, developed either myocarditis or decrease in conjecture fracture. So we stopped the Adriamycin and we stopped the Pembro. Interestingly enough, she went to the operating room. She had just residual DCIS, received her PMRT, did not continue on Pembro because the possibility of myocarditis.
I see she presented 2 years later with fulminant metastatic disease, including pleural effusions.
Presented sick, not unusual for a triple negative, with lots of shortness of breath, to a neighboring hospital, had a CAT scan, looked very suspicious for lung metastasis. She had a PET scan, bone and adrenal disease confirmed, brain was negative, cytology was performed, ER0, PR0, HER2-0, PD-L positive. Again, she was sick. I started her on SASE, and her repeat echo was 49%. She just began her second cycle. She actually is feeling better already. I guess the real big question is, with injection fracture to 49, pending the input of the cardio-oncologist, would anybody rechallenge her with pembrolizumab, given the interval and that she's PD-L positive? For those of us who are later in our career who have been limited to breast cancer, where we don't have that great of experience with the immunotherapy as some of the people who've been doing it longer.
So, Peter, any thoughts on what your experiences are in terms of cardiac issues with IOs? And also in trying to balance out the question of whether or not to rechallenge with an IO after this history, and you have to take into consideration the potential benefit, the prognosis. Any thoughts about this case, Peter?
So clinically relevant cardiac involvement or cardiac toxicity with checkpoint inhibitors is relatively rare. In the last years, however, we have had a major driver of cardiotoxicity or cardiac issues with COVID-19. And in our practice, I've seen probably 50, 60 patients in the last 4 or 5 years with both pericarditis, myocarditis, or perimyocarditis. And then the 10 years before, we had not a single patient. So COVID-19 is one of the things to consider. Obviously, in this patient, it's unclear. She was treated in the COVID-19 pandemic. Pembrolizumab could have contributed, AC could have contributed. The picture with checkpoint inhibitors is usually that if the LVEF is affected, that it recovers. So the fact that there is a slightly lower LVEF needs to be investigated. But looking at how transformative checkpoint inhibitors are, and the patient has a relatively good ejection fraction, I personally would consider rechallenging this patient if cardio-oncology is happy and monitoring it closely with BNT or other blood-based markers so that we see any signs of cardiotoxicity if this goes up. So it's not impossible from my perspective to rechallenge because I don't think we have clear evidence that it was IO-associated myocarditis.
I'm going to bring in another case, but also, Anna, you can comment on what Peter had to say. But let me bring up this other case because I know, Anna, you're so committed and involved with clinical research in triple negative. One of the issues comes up. What about some of the strategies we're seeing outside of triple negative? Will they work? I've seen CDK looked at in triple negative and other ER-positive strategies. In this case, then the patient has a PIK3 mutation, which we talk about all the time with ER-positive disease. Anyhow, here's the case, the 64-year-old lady from Dr. Gupta.
This is also almost 5 years from her original diagnosis of TNBC, which is kind of unusual because most of these patients will present within the first 2 to 3 years. So my first question is, what would the faculty recommend now in the first line metastatic setting? Her NGS shows that her CPS score is zero, so she will not be able to get pembrolizumab. She is HER2 low, MSS stable, TMB low, but oddly, she has a PIK3 mutation, which we normally see in more of the hormone receptor positive breast cancer rather than the TNBC. So the immunotherapy is out. So my question was, what would be our first line metastatic disease? Almost 5 years since original diagnosis.
Also, Anna, makes me think a little bit, maybe weirdly, about the Patina study where we saw CDK effective in HER2 positive disease, something we don't really think about. I never thought about PIK3, you know, capivasertib, for example, and triple negative. Do you know anything? Do we know anything about that?
Yeah, I think we have an expert here on the call on capivasertib and TNBC, so I'll also let Peter chime in. But unfortunately, the studies in triple-negative breast cancer with agents targeting the PI3 kinase pathway unfortunately have not panned out in demonstrating significant improvements in the phase 3 studies for PFS and OS. And so, you know, part of this may be related to developing better PI3 kinase targeting agents, the type of alterations that we see in TNBC. But in this patient outside of a clinical trial, I would not consider utilizing one of the PI3 kinase pathway inhibitors that are approved for ER positive, HER2 negative breast cancer. So for TNBC in this first line setting, 5 years out from the initial diagnosis, PD-L1 negative, the current standard would be to consider single agent chemotherapy if the patient does not have a visceral crisis, and one could consider doing single agent taxane in this setting, unless the patient had a germline BRCA1 or 2 or a PALB2 mutation, where one could potentially consider a PARP inhibitor instead. But I don't know, Peter, if you have other thoughts in terms of targeting the PI3 kinase pathway here in TNBC.
Yeah, it's a story that I still feel very sore. I spent years trying to research this. We did two randomized phase 2 trials with two different AKT inhibitors, and both showed a very strong signal on PFS and OS. When we moved into phase 3, unfortunately, those trials were negative. And the capivasertib trial with nearly 800 patients is interesting if you look at it in detail, because the primary endpoint was overall survival. There was no benefit. If you look at the secondary endpoint, which we chose for a number of reasons to be PFS, actually, if we had chosen that as the primary endpoint, it would have been significant. But you can't change your statistical design afterwards. What still haunts me a little bit is I think there may be a small subgroup of patients where that pathway actually is relevant to triple negative breast cancer. But unfortunately, we failed to demonstrate who those patients are. And therefore, at the moment, there's no role for AKT or PI3 kinase inhibitors in triple negative breast cancer, possibly because we just couldn't identify the subgroup well enough that benefits from it.
So, Peter, I don't know if I told you, but our group actually did a CME program at the AUA, American Urologic Association, on AKT inhibition in prostate cancer, because there's a press release out there that there's a positive trial, and the urologists are like, what are AKT inhibitors? But anyhow, it's another story. I want to bring in another great case, and I really appreciate Dr. Lee presenting this. Interesting situation that he came up with an innovative approach and wants to see what you think about it. It really gets into the issue of oligometastatic disease, because this patient had recurrent triple-negative breast cancer, but it was only confined to contralateral neck nodes. Here's what Dr. Lee did, and he wants your thoughts about it.
About a year and a half later, she developed isolated metastatic disease to her left neck. Interestingly enough, her breast cancer was actually the right breast. Her PET CT scan only showed disease to the neck. So she underwent a left neck dissection and a radiation. Technically, she has metastatic disease, even though she went through salvage surgery and radiation. So I started her on sacituzumab and govitecan after she completed radiation therapy. And she's been on therapy now for about 3 months, and she just got a restaging scan, and it looks good. How long would you keep the patient on sacituzumab govitecan? She technically had definitive treatment for illegal metastatic disease, but she was metastatic. And so, I mean, I plan to keep her on it as long as she tolerates, but is there an endpoint at this point? I know a lot of academic centers are able to do serial liquid biopsies and to follow for cell-free DNA. Sometimes they are able to do it under a clinical trial. It's a little more difficult in the community. So I guess my question is, if they had a patient that had quote-unquote definitive treatment, and yet the ctDNA either came back positive or remained positive, would it influence them to either keep the systemic therapy on?
So, Anna, I guess I've heard the term pseudo-adjuvant therapy when you have stage 4 NED after surgery. Obviously, we don't have a lot of clinical research data, or maybe there's more than I'm aware of, but any thoughts about this kind of a strategy? Is it too aggressive? And do you think cell-free DNA should have a role or potential role in a situation like this?
Yeah, this is an excellent question. I think so. With the development of distant, this is in essence distant nodal disease, metastatic disease, and there is likely micrometastatic circulating disease. So, while the patient has undergone quote unquote definitive local regional therapy to those cervical nodes, if the patient is now on sacituzumab govitecan, I would likely continue that and continue to scan the patient regularly. And would continue that for the time being indefinitely while the patient appears to be tolerating therapy well, and the scans don't show evidence of progression either. But I do think that this is a scenario where ctDNA can be particularly helpful. Sacituzumab govitecan obviously comes with side effects, and at some point there may be a discussion with the patient about whether to stop therapy after having been on treatment for a prolonged period of time. And here the role of ctDNA may be helpful, where if we have clearance of ctDNA and ctDNA has become negative, there may be potentially that could help support the provider and the patient in the decision to potentially stop therapy or at least take a break from therapy in the future, and then continue to monitor ctDNA in addition to scans to see if there are any changes.
So, Peter, I was looking at your face while he was presenting the case, and I was trying to read what you were thinking, but I am curious what you think about this. Also, it kind of reminds me a little bit about the issue of people presenting with de novo metastatic disease and, what you do about the primary. Do you ever operate on it? Any thoughts about these scenarios, Peter?
So if you start with this patient, I think it's a data-free zone. But we often just give local therapy and then sit tight and wait. And it comes back to, what do you want to achieve with systemic therapy? We ultimately want to keep the disease controlled for the longest possible time and maintain and improve quality of life. So we have a number of patients where we could hold back the systemic therapy for 6, 9, 12 months before we ultimately will have to start patients on therapy. The second consideration there is we are playing a card at a time when we may not have to play that card. And resistance may develop at a time where we actually don't need to play this card yet. So it's obviously always very subjective. Which patients do we select? Which patients do for systemic therapy, which not cfDNA may help. But we often sit tight, monitor those patients very closely, and only start with systemic therapy when local treatment can't hold this anymore. With your second question, when do we deal with the primary tumor in patients with metastatic disease? I think it comes down to where the bulk of the disease is. If it's a patient with one tiny bone met and a huge primary tumor, and where we are likely to run into trouble over time in terms of symptoms, tumor breaking through or infiltrating the plexus, I think in those situations there's a clear benefit from a quality of life point of view later on, not necessarily from a survival point of view, but we can stop possible complications. Whereas in a patient with extensive liver and lung metastasis, operating the primary tumor will not give any benefit. So it's a very individual decision. The trials overall failed to show an overall survival benefit, but I don't think that's necessarily the key endpoint for this question.
Yeah, certainly local control is something very important to consider. Let's go into another case, and we're going to get a little bit more into the issue of tolerability and toxicity in the triple negative metastatic setting. This is a young patient, 43 years old, but she actually had had four prior lines of chemotherapy by the time she got sacituzumab and really had a lot of problems with cytopenias. Here's Dr. Rodriguez.
She was able to get some improvement, symptomatic improvement with the neck adenopathy reduced significantly, and her bone lesions also regressed, and she had symptomatic improvement in terms of pain. But she had had a lot of chemotherapy prior to this, and she was having a lot of cytopenias around the time that we started throughout the course. She needed growth factors. Mucositis was also something that we had to deal with. And I have to say that we were not as proactive as we could have been at the beginning to prevent that. So some of the treatments were delayed because of mucositis. A young 43-year-old woman who has had four lines of chemotherapy doesn't have a good bone marrow. So she needed growth factors from the beginning. And that is part of our plan now. Also for mucositis, we're, you know, seeing washes and giving antidiarrheal agents so patients can manage symptoms better throughout the course.
So I was kind of surprised to hear about the mucositis. I've heard about that with Dato-DXd, but I don't know. I'm curious what your experience is, whether you also see with sacituzumab. And also the issue of the tolerability issues with sacituzumab. Now, again, some of these patients are going to be getting it first line, and this becomes even more important. And also what your thoughts are about this PrimeMed study that looked at preventive use of growth factors and antidiarrheals, where they did see less toxicity, but I'm not sure exactly how that translates to clinical practice. So any comments about the case and also your experience with tolerability issues with sacituzumab? Have you ever seen mucositis, for example?
Yeah, no, this is a very important point. So the more frequent side effects that we see with sacituzumab govitecan are hematologic toxicity, and in particular neutropenia and diarrhea. Mucositis is not as common, though can be, as we see it with multiple chemotherapy agents. And so the rates of mucositis with Dato-DXd or SAS-TMT, the other TROP2 ADCs that have been reported, are much higher. And in fact, primary prophylaxis is recommended with those agents using mouthwash at least four times per day. So in somebody who's developed mucositis, such as in this case, I think optimizing management certainly is key. From a hematologic perspective, I think this is a very important point about use of primary prophylaxis in patients at high risk of severe neutropenia. So obviously we tend to use with sacituzumab govitecan if a patient has developed neutropenia as secondary prophylaxis, short-acting growth factor support on days 2 through 4, and then long-acting growth factor support on day 9 of each cycle of SG. But in patients who are at particularly high risk of severe neutropenia, and that includes patients of older age, with comorbidities, poor performance status, patients who, you know, the bone marrow has been exposed to many cytotoxic agents before, who have history of neutropenia, these are instances in where utilizing primary prophylaxis is key. And so in a heavily pretreated setting such as this, I think primary prophylaxis is very important. And also now, as you know, we potentially see these antibody-drug conjugates move into the first-line setting, but with many patients receiving chemotherapy in the neoadjuvant-adjuvant setting and regimens such as KEYNOTE-522 that carry multiple cytotoxic regimens, I think this is also very important to consider. And then the PrimeMed study. So this was a very nice study that looked at primary prophylaxis with growth factor support for neutropenia, and then also with loperamide for diarrhea. You know, we've talked about the management of neutropenia from a diarrhea perspective. We educate patients about use of antidiarrheals and promptly reporting any GI symptoms that they do develop with sacituzumab govitecan. Some institutions do also administer atropine to prevent rapid onset of diarrhea with SG. I think this depends a little bit on the patient profile as well. But use of loperamide and other antidiarrheals as needed, the education is key for management of these side effects.
So, Peter, again, any thoughts and maybe recount some of your experiences in terms of tolerability, toxicity with SASI? But also, you know, and when you start thinking about combining sacituzumab with an IO, I was kind of remembering thinking about, for example, pembro lenvatinib, where you can get diarrhea from either one. Do you see any situations where if you're going to be giving an IO like Pember with SASE, where maybe it might be a little confusing, like diarrhea, which one is the causative agent?
When you combine different drugs, it's never 100% clear which drug is causing a side effect. But over time, I think we've managed to get a good feel for what is more SG or what is more IO related toxicity, and that refers to diarrhea as well. With the ADCs, our experience is that we had a huge learning curve. And 6, 7, 8 years ago, when we started working with ADCs, we saw substantially more toxicity than we see now. For example, diarrhea is something we see very infrequently now with sacituzumab govitecan, and this is down to the prophylactic use of triplet antiemetic prophylaxis, which obviously is constipating in as a side effect, plus a very early use of loperamide. And as a result, diarrhea doesn't play a huge role anymore, whether we give it alone or in combination with checkpoint inhibitors. We're also increasingly moving towards primary prophylaxis with G-CSF. And so the two primary toxicity factors of SG, diarrhea and neutropenia in clinical practice, play a relatively low role for us. Finally, we haven't, I may have missed it in the presentation, but we also obviously have the option of reducing the dose. And that's very clearly outlined. We know that the drug is still highly effective if you go down to 7.5 or even 5.5 milligrams per kg. And that together with optimal supportive care leads to a situation where practically all patients will cope well with this drug.
Yeah, and you heard this patient was on SASE for a year, I think did have dose reduction, had tumor-related symptoms that were improved, so a really critical strategy. Let's try to go through one more case and get into something that was mentioned earlier by Dr. Rudolph, the issue of brain mets and also screening for brain mets. This is a 76-year-old woman, ER-negative HER2-low breast cancer. So now we have the consideration of T-DXd and issues related to the brain with an isolated brain metastasis. Here's Dr. Gupta again.
This is a patient who actually presented to us after she had altered mental status, went to the ER, was found to have a brain mass, and then they resected it and which was found to be consistent with triple negative kind of cancer, adenocarcinoma, ERPR, HER2 negative. And the only other history that we had was that in 1981, she had a right breast mass for which she had mastectomy done, did not have any treatments at that time in the adjuvant setting. We later on found that she had a cystosarcoma phylloides. But when I examined her, I felt a lump in the scar tissue there. So I had my surgeon go and excise that. And lo and behold, we had TNBC there. So obviously the brain mets was metastatic from that. So initially we just resected the breast mass, we resected the brain lesion, and we just observed her because there was no other evidence of disease, just because of, you know, patient wanted that. But within a few months, then she had some lung lesions which started to grow. I started her on capecitabine. She did not tolerate the capecitabine well at all. She was HER2 low. So I talked to her and said, you know, TXD would have some brain penetration, so that may be a good option for her for systemic and brain mets control. So we started that on her. So I just kind of wanted to ask the faculty of any opinion about these type of cases, any recommendations for her treatment.
Anna, any final thoughts about this case and also the issue, as she was alluding to, of a response in the brain? Certainly with HER2-positive disease, we see great responses at T-DXd. What about in HER2-low disease? And any thoughts about this case?
Yes, no, thank you for the question. Here, this patient now, in addition to CNS disease, also has extracranial disease, it sounds like. So I think that's also very important to take into consideration when deciding the appropriate treatment. We've certainly seen emerging data for T-DXd also in smaller cohorts looking at this in patients with HER2-low CNS, including active CNS disease, suggesting that there can also be activity of T-DXd in this patient population. And we're also starting to see some data for the TROP2 ADCs, We know that SG also has CNS penetrance, and there are some ongoing clinical trials looking at both SG and Dato-DXd specifically in patients with central nervous system disease. So, you know, in this case, I certainly would talk certainly consider the options. But in addition to the CNS, the presence of CNS disease, I think that the extracranial disease we also have to think about as well.
That's a great point, and we're going to bring this to a close. Anna and Peter, thank you so much for working with us today. Special thanks to the docs who presented cases. We're so appreciative of their interest in trying to educate us. Audience, thank you for attending. Have a great day. Thanks so much, Anna. Thanks, Peter.
Thanks.
Thank you very much.